Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater from New Jersey, and your moderator for this morning. Today is Sunday, May 18, 2025. The share ID numbers for Friday, May 16th, are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,441, that's 22441. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,440. Yes, 22440. This morning, A Vision for You presents A Letter to My Past Self. The program of recovery is contained in the Big Book, a textbook with a precise set of suggestions for working each step. The sole purpose of this step work is to find power through the experience of a spiritual awakening. The actual intended program of recovery is a personal transformation. Through following the clear-cut suggestions for each of the 12 steps described in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The writers tell us if we want what they have, we must do what they did. What did the first 100 do? What was their knowledge and experience in regards to the program of recovery and the steps? Perhaps we need to revisit the ingredients, beliefs, views, and actions of the original founders, and then reflect upon our current ingredients, beliefs, and actions. Are they based on truth, or has there been a distortion through our limited vision, our limited views and perceptions? It's possible any of our beliefs and perceptions about the program of recovery, about the Big Book in its entirety, and the steps are far from being aligned with the program of recovery as outlined in the Big Book and are actually blocks to our recovery. Joining us today to elaborate on this topic is John Kay, a recovered compulsive overeater from Los Angeles, California. John is a loyal servant of Overeaters Anonymous, a beloved friend and guest speaker of A Vision for You, dedicated to carrying the message of recovery. And it's always a privilege, a delight, and an honor to welcome John Kay to the line. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Leah. Wow, that's a buildup. I gotta see if I can meet now. It's nice hearing you again.
Great to hear you,
good
John.
Morning. Yeah, good morning, everyone. I'm John Kiernan, recovered compulsive eater in Los Angeles. So, you know, at the treatment center I work at, I have a writing exercise I do with my groups. It's called Letter to My Past Self. The idea of the exercise is to look at where we are today and think about where we were in the past. What kinds of messages will we send to the younger us based on what we've learned, especially what we've learned in program? I found myself thinking about this exact thing the other day. What would I say to my younger self? And trust me, when you get to my age, you really wish you could. Well, first, I had to think about who's the John of today. Well, the John of today is absolutely unrecognizable from the John in my 20s when I joined OA and AA. Obviously, I was heavier then. I was a lot heavier. But there was more than the physical heaviness. There was the emotional and spiritual heaviness that I carried around with me every day. And I saw the world through a dark lens. You know, people were inherently no good. This was a horrible world to live in. And if you saw the truth the way I did, you'd drink and eat too. Well, today I don't feel that way. I don't see other people that way, and I don't see the world that way. You know, the main thing that's come from looking at the world with that new pair of glasses that the program taught me to wear is that I don't see myself the way I did then, as a failure, as a loser. And as one is in so much pain that alcohol and food was the only way to make day-to-day life tolerable. You know, everything in the future back then just seemed like a black wall. Finally, something gave me a spark of hope. And it certainly didn't come organically from the John of the early 80s. It happened soon after I left an alcohol rehab. I had left that rehab, stopped at the supermarket for booze and binge foods, and then went home. Anyone who went from the rehab to home and then a liquor store, well, that's an amateur. Now, I remember clearly waking up the next day and deciding to go to that stupid AA clubhouse that the people in the rehab had been taking us to. And to this day, I can't tell you what happened to make the person who went to a liquor store first on a Saturday decide to go to an AA meeting on Sunday morning. Well, I have an idea what that power was, but I'll never be able to know for sure, at least not in this life. But something pushed me to get up on a cold January morning and walk a mile to an AA clubhouse. And I remember walking out into the sunshine and saying, what a beautiful day. Too bad I can't enjoy it. I swear I actually said that sentence out loud. Now, look, I don't mean to belabor my AA experience, but that day was the key to my recovery. See, on one level, I desperately needed that program, but on another, I fought against many of the details of the steps instead of seeing the big picture. You know, and I don't know what happened during that meeting, but I was helping put away chairs after the meeting, and I was arguing with an old-timer about AA. I said to him, I can't be an AA. You guys are a bunch of religious people, and I'm an atheist. And he smiled and told me, well, it wasn't a religious program. It's a spiritual one. And I snorted and said, look, I pointed to the steps and said, look, right there. God, 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 him with a capital H. So he looked at the steps and he looked back at me and he said, okay, leave it out. What? He said, you can be here till you're 110 years old. Nobody's going to tell you what to believe or that you have to believe anything at all. And then he said, we'll ask just one thing of you. Just try and keep an open mind on the subject. Well, you know, those words allowed that little mustard seed to jam into the door of my otherwise closed mind. I could resign from the debating society and join the program that I so desperately needed. Well, two programs, actually. Today, I have a belief in a higher power, but it looks nothing like the one I was raised with. You know, I think we're all given a hand-me-down God that we have to tear down and rebuild. Now, it might very well end up as the same that you with. But then it'll be your higher power, not somebody else's higher power. But I'm not here to tell my AA story, or my OA story for that matter, but that was the first step in turning my life around. It was going to be a tough battle, though. I was angry, self-willed, a totally arrogant know-it-all, and had more character defects than you could shake a stick at. Of course, these defects were all developed in a crazy world that I was raised in. You know, these defects weren't insane behaviors. They were actually sane coping mechanisms developed in an insane environment. Now, I wish I could say those defects were quickly removed, but they were not. That future that I saw as a black wall didn't diminish overnight, but instead it turned into a thick fog. My job was to just keep walking through it, and more was revealed as I went along. I was told by people in the program that I respected that I just needed to take the next indicated step. I also wish I could say I was abstinent from that day forward and had the same 42 years of recovery in this program that I have in the other one. But the truth was I slipped and slid for a long time, 13 years to be exact. And a big part of why that relapse cycle lasted so long was that I had failed to enlarge my spiritual experience, condition, I mean. Even when I was graced with the abstinence I have today, I still carry many of those defects. You know, we call them maladaptive behaviors in my business. On the surface, I seem to be growing in my recovery. I worked the steps. I read the big book, even memorized large passages of it so I could impress people at meetings. But there's a difference between reading the big book and truly embracing the life it guides us towards. Well, anyway, that's a bit of a picture of the John I was then. You know, today, I've reached a place in my life where I like myself, and I do my best to be a good example program to others. I care about others more than myself now. You know, people come to me for guidance now. I mean, somebody said to me recently, I'd like to hear your wisdom on this. I had to look around and see if they were talking about somebody else. You know, me? Wisdom? Well, you know, it's sort of true now. I just won't tell that person how batshit crazy I used to be. I've reached that day-to-day outlook that the book promised me. The book talks about serenity, but I think of it more as contentment, just pure contentment. And a huge part of that had to do with having the majority of my ego, the part that worked against me, taken from me. I now understand why talk of losing the ego and self-centeredness is so important. It's absolutely crucial to achieving those promises talked about on pages 83 to 85 of the Big Book. Now, could this metamorphosis from an angry, dark, arrogant young man to the content person I am today have come about without the steps in the Big Book? We think not. Now, I'm not telling you all this to say, ooh, look how evolved I've become. It's a few minutes with either my sponsor or my wife would change your mind on that. The fact, though, is I have changed, and my perspective has changed on many things, including programs. So I found myself thinking about that writing exercise I had my group do the other day, and what would I say to my younger self? I think that would depend on the age of the me I would be addressing. You know, if I were to address the me in early school, I think I'd tell them that other kids are cruel and to try as best as you can to not listen to those taunts about being fat. I'd explain to them that those bullies were that way because they didn't feel good about themselves, that it really wasn't about him. I'd also tell him he's not nearly as fat as those kids, or his own mind made him believe. I'd reassure him he wasn't crazy when he thought there was something really wrong with his life. I don't think he could have understood that both of his parents were totally unstable alcoholics. I would have just told him that when everyone around him is saying the sky is green and he saw it as blue, to trust his perceptions in life. But I wouldn't have told him to not overeat, because it was the only coping mechanism he had to deal with this crazy world he inhabited. You know, it was the only companion he had when he moved from city to city to city to city. And food was the warm hug he could get nowhere else. Now, if I was speaking to my adolescent self, I'd tell him that he was absolutely right in his assessment that he should never drink. His genetics and upbringing all but guaranteed he'd become the very thing he despised in his parents, an alcoholic. I'd explain that he could find other ways to find self-esteem and ways to talk to women without being so drunk that it overrode how he actually felt about himself. However, the letter I think I'd really want to write more than any is the letter I'd like to write to the me from earlier in my recovery. Firstly, I'd tell him to not settle for just being sober and abstinent because he had a lot of work to do. I'd tell him he could prevent a lot of heartache and regret if he used the Big Book for something other than a doorstop for his first few years. Now, the trouble is that the me of that time was arrogant and clueless about life. And as a result, I don't think there was anything I could have written to him that he wouldn't have cynically scoffed at because he was smarter than everyone else, you know, even his future self. Well, this is one of the ways I've grown. You know, I had all the answers 20 years ago. Well, even 10 years ago. You know, today I'm wary of people with sets of absolute beliefs about anything. And that includes beliefs about program, sets, the Big Book. I believe that means when those people are presented with new information that challenges one or more of those absolute beliefs, they'll tend to dig in to defend them rather than keep an open mind about new ideas. Well, the main thing I think I would have talked to my younger me about was his attitude about program, steps, the Big Book. I would have asked him, like I do sponsees, to take a few steps back and remember why he came to program, and possibly reassess his beliefs about program. You know, yes, I wanted to lose weight, but I was also miserable and couldn't see how life could be tolerable without something, you know, take the edge off. And if only half of what these people in program were telling me could come true based on those promises, I'd have been very happy. But the main trouble I had was how I viewed the whole 12-step experience. Now, you know, I think mine was a typical journey. You know, when you come into program, you start going to meetings, and you begin to mentally build a picture about program, what the norms are, quirky language that people use is, what's expected of members. And you hear others talking about their abstinence or relapses, and you hear them beating themselves up for their slipping, and you begin to build a mental picture about program and abstinence. I then did what most of us do. I fell in line with my impressions of the program and moved forward. You know, I never, until recently, ever took a step back to reassess my beliefs about the program, most of which had been absorbed by me in my early days of recovery. Now, I think it's critical to remember why we keep coming to programming. It's very easy to start shifting views of the disease and recovery based on outside input. You know, if we decided the program might be the answer to our problem, we begin to absorb what's being said by other people in meetings. Now, that's totally fine, as long as we can distinguish between what the program truly says versus what other people's interpretations of what the program is saying. You know, those are their interpretations, and they're based on the recovery they have at that moment. But they don't have to be seen as immutable facts. You know, some people see a blue sky, some people see a green sky. The important thing is to look up and decide for yourself what that color is. You know, we learn about the steps and how they'll help us achieve the goals we came to achieve. And along the way, we begin to see that the changes these steps suggest will help us navigate life better. We then add these things to the things we want from program. You know, yes, we want to be at a healthy body weight and be relieved of compulsive eating. And then through the big book on the steps, we learn that those things can happen and we can be happier and more serene as well. I mean, that's pretty cool. So I got involved in program. I worked the steps. I read the big book. I saw a lot of the wreckage of my life start to heal and repair itself. And as a result, I became absolutely convinced that these gifts from program had come from working the steps and reading the big book exactly the way it was taught to me. And looking back, though, I can see there's one undeniable fact when it comes to the steps and the big book. We all see them through the eyes of the person we are at that moment, with the recovery we have at that moment. Now, one of the distorted ways of thinking I had, at least then, is called black and white thinking. I dealt with everything I believed with the arrogance of my early sobriety. You know, once I learned something and came to believe it, that was it. If you didn't agree with me, you were wrong and I was right. Well, you know, that kind of thinking isn't very mature. The world isn't black and white. It's not even many shades of gray. It's a world with infinite colors. And there were and are many ways to work the program. But if your way didn't jive with my idea of recovery and how to work the program, well, again, you were wrong, I was right. I thought people who had different views just needed to be schooled in the right way to approach the program, which was, of course, my way of approaching the program. Now, in one way, that thinking was logical. It was based on the empirical evidence I had from my own experiences and from looking around me. Many of my program friends who had gotten recovery got it the same way I had. It was all about the steps and the big book, and you believed anything else, you were obviously still in denial one way or another, full stop. Now, in retrospect, there's nothing wrong with believing what I believed then about program and big book. In fact, it's pretty much what I believe now. However, my approach to it all has mellowed with age. You know, I used to talk about the program like it was a college course that had to be followed exactly. The big book was the syllabus. Today, I see things a little differently, or at least from a different angle. You know, I've joked that what we need is a chapter called Why It Works. You know, instead of dictating to them exactly what to do, I want people to see why doing the things in the big book will help them. That it's not just a rite of passage they have to go through. And with the mellowing that I guess comes with age, I started to look at all different aspects of the program in a different light. You know, I don't have to have that black and white thinking, nor the tunnel vision I had about program. These days, my way of talking about program, the steps, and the big book comes from a place of, here's what I did, rather than here's what you have to do, or here is the way of being recovered with food. Now, looking back, I can see I failed program in an essential way. You know, yes, I was abstinent and had a healthy body weight. Yes, I was relieved of that constant obsession with the food and also happy, joyous, and free. Actually, everything having to do with me was going pretty well. But I had a further obligation, and that was to pass on the message, to be of maximum service to others. But nowadays, I see this, just for me, is an obligation to help the most people, not just those who will agree with my way of seeing recovery. I've helped a lot of people earlier in my recovery, but it was those who agreed with my way of approaching recovery. You know, I and my friends were in some of an echo chamber. We essentially preached to the choir among ourselves. We saw evidence that our philosophy was right simply by looking around us. But in looking back, I wonder if that was an illusion of success. you know, how many people might we have driven off with our concrete, this is the way to do it philosophy? I mean, is that really carrying the message to the best of my abilities? Well, I guess it was the best of my abilities then, but it isn't now. You know, I've learned to detach my ego from any questions about what success in program looks like and deal with the newcomer or relapser in front of me. In the recovery business, we talk about, quote, meeting people where they're at. I needed to take a few steps back and reassess my previous beliefs based on a realistic assessment of recovery from the compulsive eating disease. And that involves looking at how all people work the program, not just the ones who work it the way I think they should. So these days, I apply a why it works attitude toward both newcomers and people in relapse. Firstly, I ask people to remember why they came and to remember that they can leave at any time. They're adults and they have agency. At the same time, they have a disease that desperately wants to convince them that abstinence, a food plan, the steps, and the program in general are all things imposed on them. The disease wants to convince them that abstinence is deprivation. It tries to put up all these things, things meant to help us, in the light of an authority figure. And, you know, who doesn't want to rebel against an authority figure? I explain that this is their program and that they can decide how it works any way they want. I tell them there's a reason you here take what you want and leave the rest so much in program. At the same time, I warn them that we have a disease that wants to grab that saying and run like hell with it. You see, that's what makes recovery from compulsive eating so difficult. We have to thread the needle in so many ways. Now, I give my opinion of what I find works best. What I explain is just my opinion. But I think it keeps people from falling into that program as an authority figure trap. You know, this needs to be a program of people who want it, not people who have to do it. Take the steps. We're told we need to start working the steps as soon as possible. But is it a requirement for staying abstinent? Of course not. I talk about my experience, how the steps changed my life. I explain that the changes you make by working the steps can make your life better and help you maintain your abstinence more easily. And I mean, who wouldn't want to make their abstinence easier, right? But I tell them that working or not working the steps is still a choice they get to make. We come in the program and are immediately confronted with talk of God and a higher power. You know, we hear many people in meetings talk about their higher power, sometimes in a way that you might hear in a revival tent. Now, it's certainly their choice and it's their reality, but it can be a little off-putting to those who don't necessarily ascribe to a Judeo-Christian view of a higher power. But I'll explain to those new people that in the big book, page 45 tells us that the main objective of the book is to help us find some kind of a power greater than ourselves to help us with our problem. Now, in actuality, is having this connection a requirement to achieve abstinence? Again, of course not. Most of us, however, would suggest that developing a connection with something greater than yourself is another one of those things that will make your abstinence and your life in general easier. As with the steps, I explain to them that this is a choice that they get to make and that they should never feel any peer pressure to conform to the things that they hear at meetings about other people's gods or higher powers. I point out to them that there are atheist meetings of all 12-step programs, and lo and behold, those people stay abstinent and sober as well. As for a food plan, I explain that it's highly suggested they should develop a food plan, hopefully with the help of a sponsor or an objective third party. I explain we need objective third parties to help us because, after all, we know what the optimum food plan would be if left to us, whatever we want, as much as we want, whenever we want it. I explain that having some guardrails around the food guarantees that they, not the disease, is driving the bus. Still, is having a food plan something that's necessary to continue in program? Of course not. And speaking about developing a food plan, I can explain to them that they can be as loose or as strict as they choose. However, they will be the only person affected by their choices, and therefore they have to accept the consequences of those choices. If they choose to have the kind of food plan that, you know, Henry VIII could follow, well, they can, but they shouldn't be surprised if they don't find themselves able to get down to that weight they'd hoped to achieve. If instead they choose a super restrictive food plan, they can, But if they continually keep straying from that food plan, they might want to ask themselves if perhaps that food plan might not be conducive to achieving their long-term abstinence. However, for some people, I'll explain to them a tighter food plan does work best. A more specific food plan can make it easier for some people to stay abstinent. For others, though, a restrictive food plan just won't work for them in the long term. The key is objectively looking at what works for you and what doesn't. But it's also important to remember that our disease has a component of denial. So talking over things with an objective third party is crucial. I heard someone say recently at a meeting that her food plan was like a comforting warm sweater, not a straitjacket. Another thing I tell them to remember is this. You get to decide what foods go on your red light list, you know, foods you can't eat like a lady or gentleman. I tell them to remember they're in Overeaters Anonymous. They're not in Sugar Anonymous. They're not in White Flour Anonymous. They're not in Artificial Sweeteners Anonymous. Now I will then follow that up by explaining to them that for many of us, sugar and flour can be triggers. I tell them staying away from certain foods is our choice, but it's based on logic. If we find eating certain things makes us relapse or makes us just staying abstinent harder, we choose not to eat those things. We choose to do these things, not because we can't eat those things, but because it makes our abstinence easier. It makes us saner. It keeps us from along that slippery slope that can lead back to relapse. But I warn them that the disease will want to convince them that giving up their problem foods is deprivation, but it's not. It's a favor to ourselves to make our lives easier. I mean, they're called problem foods for a reason, you know. Anyway, all of these are things and subjects I wish I'd been able to talk to the younger me about working the program. I mean, I made many, many mistakes. I made mistakes in judgment. I made mistakes in how I approached the program. I especially made mistakes in how I worked with sponsees and newcomers. You know, the thing I did as a sponsor then came from that here's what you do attitude, not from the here's what I did place. You know, I think about the list of things I did as a sponsor in the past and I wince. You know, I would tell people what to eat. What? Do I have a degree in nutrition? No. I would give life advice. You know, did I have any specific training as a therapist at that time? No. I would tell people what meetings they needed to go to. And if they pushed back on any of my numerous other dictates, I'd pull out the old, well, is that willing to go to any lengths of mine? I would get upset if a sponsee slipped. My ego told me that I was, quote, getting them abstinent. And they obviously didn't want it if they were slipping. You know, there was no kindness or compassion for a suffering fellow when they failed to live up to my idea of surrender. I mean, didn't I get this as a disease? You know, I look back and shake my head at the my way or the highway approach. Yes, the way I spoke about work for me and many of my friends, but again, I wonder how many newcomers did I drive off with my way of carrying the message? Why not the same message have been delivered in a kinder, more loving way? Just like I was saying about the big book, we sponsor at the level of recovery we have at the moment, which is often not as recovered as we want to think. I joke that I even went through a phase I called stark raving abstinent. Now, I'm not sure how much of this change in perspective about program was due to some newfound maturity or how much came from going back to school to study addiction further. But here's another change of view I've had in recent years. You know, earlier in my life, I went to another food program for a while. I had a very strict food plan because I so wanted alcohol and food to be the same. It would just make my understanding of the disease so much simpler. But food and alcohol just aren't the same. I wish they were. You know, for years, I tried to tell myself repeatedly that all people had to do is surrender in the same way as alcoholics and addicts do, just follow the big book and use it as a guide. I wanted that because I believe in the big book and the steps and the 12-step program and its philosophy. I think they are an absolutely perfect fit, like a key in a lock, for alcoholism and addiction. Unfortunately, and this may be sacrilege to some, I don't think 12-step programs are a perfect fit, key in a lock, for all compulsive eaters. Now, we know the program works. Anyone who's gone to a Vision for You convention or a birthday party knows it works. I mean, 1,000 people can't be wrong. But But our disease is different than alcohol and drugs because our substance is different. You know, I often speak about how food's toughest hurdle to overcome has to do with the method with which it delivers its pain. You know, alcohol and drugs can inflict acute pain that might eventually get through to the sufferer. The effect of compulsive eating is different, though. The pain the food delivers isn't an acute pain. It's a dull, chronic pain that makes you realize you should do something about it, but very often not enough pain to get to the willing to go to any length threshold. You know, we're also dealing with a substance that has to be put in our body multiple times every day. Now, I know people say alcoholics have to drink, we just can't drink alcohol, but, you know, I'm a recovered alcoholic, and I never had a drink of any non-alcoholic drink that made me consider drinking again. However, I've been in a not-fit spiritual condition, and when dinner was over, I wanted to continue by cleaning out the refrigerator. You know, I heard someone say at a meeting recently that relapse is all about the buildup of emotions that sets a series of choices into action. Well, you know, I certainly believe that in terms of going out to a liquor store or copping drugs off the corner. But is it a buildup of emotions that gets a compulsive eater to start popping things into her mouth while cooking dinner? I mean, food is, if you excuse the expression, in our face constantly. You know, we can see that it doesn't work perfectly for everyone simply by looking at the numbers. We should be the largest 12-step organization in the world because there are certainly way more compulsive eaters than there are alcoholics or addicts. And yet we're not. Now, is this a problem with the steps? No. Is it a problem with the big book? No. I believe it stems from our inability to help all people who come to the program to find a way to turn that imperfect key and lock into the perfect key and lock that it is for many of us. To me, it's about meeting people better where they're at, which is why I focus on highlighting the parts of the big book that will resonate with them and acknowledge that some parts just may not. It's like having a repair manual for one model and not realizing you have a different model. I mean, it'll work part of the way until it doesn't. You know, these days I've been working with a lot of people who are in the relapse cycle. Many of these people have been in program for 10, 20, 30 years, but have had trouble stringing together long periods of abstinence. And I was talking to somebody with long-term recovery about these people recently, and he said, well, they're obviously just not willing enough. Not willing. These are people who have been coming back for decades trying to make that key work in the lock. Would you be willing to keep going for decades on something else you continue to fail at? To me, these people would seem to be the epitome of willingness. But when it comes to putting down the food, they're not people who won't, but people who can't. I'm convinced, though, that the can't does not have to be a permanent situation. And I know because I was in that relapse cycle for 14 years. I was going to 4 to 5 meetings a week. I had a sponsor. I was delegate to my inner group. I was studying the big book and the steps and doing whatever my sponsor told me to do. And still that key wouldn't turn. Finally, after a long time of trying the same routine to hold on to my abstinence, the key turned in the lock. Was it something I did? No. To me, it was grace. I was given the gift of abstinence. But it took me years to understand that it was a gift, but also a gift I could let go of at any time. And a day doesn't go by where I don't thank my higher power for that gift. You know, the younger me didn't get this fact that I didn't get abstinent. I was given the gift of abstinence. And as a result, after a few years of my newfound abstinence, my attitude toward others who were relapsing changed. I couldn't remember the frustration and the feeling there was something wrong with me because I couldn't get what everybody else was getting. I forgot what it was like to not be abstinent when so many other people are getting up at the podium and talking about how wonderful life is with abstinence. I forgot how it felt when I sat there going, what's wrong with me? How come they're getting it and I can't? I couldn't see that my sponsees who kept failing were trying just as hard as I had been trying all those years and sadly getting the same results. And I had yet to develop something as a sponsor that only came to me later, compassion. You know, when I think of the level of recovery I had then, I want to go make amends to all those sponsees that had yet to receive that gift. You know, sadly, I let more than one sponsee go because they, quote, wouldn't put down the fork. My God, these were people who needed me the most at that moment. It was my ego at work because I decided I couldn't get them abstinent. I couldn't get them abstinent like I can get anyone abstinent. And so what did I do instead? I let them go and I added to their shame and guilt instead of redoubling my efforts and my caring and my compassion. You know, I believe alcoholism and addiction are binary disorders. You know, you're either drinking or you're not. There are no beer-only AA meetings. But unlike those addictions, I believe compulsive eating is more of a spectrum disorder. In other words, like we've heard for years, some are sicker than others. I have a friend, Roberta, who many in LA know. It's also a lot of people in the New York area where she lived for many years. Roberta can eat all foods moderately. I wish I could, but I can't. Now, I know Roberta isn't lying about this or faking that she's a compulsive eater. If you've heard her story, you know she qualifies for the program. She just happens to have been blessed with a milder form of the disease than most. There was a girl at my home meeting back in L.A., Serenity Sunday, who got up to take a 90-day chip a few years back. And when she got up to speak, she said, you know, I had 4 years of abstinence. But then I tried to be Roberta. You know, we're all different, and we all have different stories. Some people's stories are such that I don't have any trouble believing they're compulsive eaters. I have trouble believing they're still alive. I have trouble believing that they're not permanently institutionalized based on the horrible trauma they've experienced in their lives. Is it any wonder that they may have had more trouble getting and staying abstinent than many of us? You know, I talk to these chronic relapsers about the program that saved my life. I talk to them about the steps and recovery in a much kinder, gentler way than I did at an earlier time in my life. I know they've read the big book and worked the steps often over and over, but they haven't been able to connect with the big book the way I had. Again, they read the same words and sentences I had, but they haven't been able to find that connection. So I spent a lot of time reframing things spoken about in the big book in a way that might help people better understand and connect with it. You know, until you really connect with the big book on a visceral level, it's still just more of that textbook to be studied than an outline to a better way of life. You know, I would also tell the younger me that he may want to reassess what recovery from compulsive eating looks like and what success looks like. You know, I wanted to get all of my sponsees to have long-term back-to-back abstinence. Now, I think it's an important and admirable goal. It means you're getting through everything life has to throw at you and not turn to some substance or other means for dealing with adverse circumstances. And yeah, it'll probably hurt more, but it's very often where the true growth comes. At the same time, is to count days on a calendar the true measure of recovery? Is it numbers on a scale? Is it how many pages of the big book you can memorize? You know, to me, it's very easy to lose the forest for the trees when it comes to the big book. It wasn't one particular page that helped me. It wasn't a chapter or a sentence. It was the whole concept being taught. And it taught me numerous lessons. You know, the first lesson it taught me was how to get through life's tough episodes. And I went through the death of both parents, a divorce, and other trying times, without looking for relief from the outside.
John, press star one. John, press star one to unmute, please.
Well, I dropped out there, folks. We are
Welcome
the prisoners
back.
Of our tech. We are prisoners of our technology, I always say. All right, let's see if we can take this up from about where I think I left it when all of a sudden I heard bloop on my phone. The second lesson it taught me the program and steps taught me is how I can be happy, joyous, and free. It taught me, somebody's unmuted, by the way. The second lesson it taught me is that I can be happy, joyous, and free. It taught me that happiness, peace, and contentment have nothing to do with what's going on outside me or around me. It's an inside job. It taught me that the key to that serenity was really getting the concept of acceptance at a gut level. Acceptance of circumstances, acceptance of other people, and especially acceptance of myself. It helped me realize that I'm a human being. I will always make mistakes. But that book also taught me how to make amends as quickly as possible. A third lesson it taught me was how to be a good person. You know, not just the people I liked and agreed with on things, but everyone. Again, everyone has a story. Everyone has a history. And it may include some awful events. Those kinds of things often make people, at least some people, bitter and angry. And every so often, I'll run into people like this who are quick to lash out and unload their bitterness on me. Well, you know, the thing about living your life trying to be the best person you can and hurting no one is that you become bulletproof. I mean, I know I'm okay, and I would never do anything deliberately to hurt you. So if you're upset with me, I'm really sorry, but it's your problem, not mine. You know, there's an old saying that goes, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them back. And the final lesson that it taught me was a lesson wrapped inside an obligation. And that obligation is to try to pass on that which was so freely given to me. And to me, that's about helping as many people as possible find that path to recovery. And I've come to see that this obligation means helping people find recovery without judgment of how they do it or how long it takes them, or what that recovery looks like. You know, love and tolerance of others is our code, and we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even sponsees. Now, I've known people with tremendous physical recovery, many of whom are looked up to in program. Now, most of those people are the shiny examples of recovery that others think they are. However, I've known people who are well-known in program who behind the scenes don't exactly reflect the principles of the program. Now, they're not bad people. They're just humans missing some things in their lives that I hope to truly get. But it begs the question, what is recovery? You know, through my work with people who are sometimes branded as, quote, chronic relapsers, I often see huge amounts of wisdom and growth and compassion in them, probably because of their hard uphill struggle. Now, I truly regret having treated people who slipped sometimes as if they were misbehaving children. It was as if I thought anything they learned in program was wiped out by a lapse in judgment or encountering that strange mental blank spot. Yeah, they may have lacked recovery in one area, but I lacked it in another. There was something missing in me that drove that character defect that had me look for reasons to feel superior to people who were relapsed. Because mainly, deep down, I actually felt inferior to everyone. You know, we have a saying in program, don't leave before the miracle. And sadly, I think one of the reasons we're not the biggest 12-step organization in the world is that people do leave before the miracle. But why did they leave? I think it's because the amount of encouragement from those around them in program doesn't overcome the amount of discouragement they feel at continuing to fail. You know, we're in a war against a virulent disease that can be fatal if not arrested. You know, we're all in a foxhole together fighting against it. And if one of our fellows gets wounded, we need to rush to help them in any way we can. And sadly, I think there's some people who think relapsing is contagious and stay away from that person. It just reinforces in the victim of the disease that relapsing should be a source of shame. The fact is, we have a disease, and like other diseases, there can be setbacks and recurrences. We need to remember that people who are in relapse are victims of their disease, not the perpetrators. Their difficulty in getting the gift of abstinence only hurts them. And this is one of the main reframings I try to point out. We fall into something of a groupthink that makes us feel shame and guilt when we relapse. But again, my relapses didn't hurt anybody but me. But somewhere in my head, I felt like I let people down. And my black and white thinking had me putting people into two categories, abstinent or not abstinent. which also equated to good or bad. And obviously, because I relapsed, I was bad. You know, even though Dr. Silkworth was the lone voice in the wilderness in 1935, it's now accepted scientific and medical knowledge that addiction is a disease. But our disease resides in our brain, which makes it harder for some people to accept. You know, another disease, epilepsy, has a similar situation. An MRI cannot directly confirm the diagnosis of epilepsy, but we know it exists in people because they have seizures. And the difference between our two diseases is that when an epileptic has a seizure, he doesn't feel guilty about it later. You know, I always wonder if my 14-year relapse cycle might have been shortened with a different attitude about the disease and recovery. Now, I didn't need to feel shame. I didn't need to feel guilt. I think I learned that from others who relapsed, talking about their guilt and shame. You know, it became contagious. Now, should I have been disappointed in myself? Sure. I think if you have no bad feelings about slips, then you're going to normalize them, and then the disease is driving the bus again. Sadly, I think this is a place where OA drops the ball a little and concerning a lack of sponsors overall. Now, Vision does a much better job of getting sponsors available to people on the calls, but Vision is still just a small part of OA. And thus, newcomers or people coming back from relapse go to local meetings, and often there's no sponsors available. And the ones who are available are loaded down with many sponsees because so few others are stepping up to be part of the solution. You know, we talk about throwing people a lifeline, but if the other end of that lifeline isn't attached to something, then all they have is a piece of rope. Well, the good news is that there are meetings where things are better, like Vision for You. You know, the people listening to this today have the same belief in the steps and the program and the Big Book as I do. I just hope you can do a better job of carrying the message to those who still suffer than I did. I wish I could have been more flexible with my sponsees, except that what worked for me might not work for them. You know, at the end of the day, sadly, I can't send a letter to the me of the past. But what I can do is impart things I've learned, and hopefully that can go far in helping the most people achieve recovery. You know, find compassion, find patience. Keep an open mind that just because somebody's approaching the program differently than you doesn't make them wrong, just different. You know, to me, the here's what I did method is way more likely to help another suffering compulsive eater than the here's what you need to do method. So I'll end this by retelling a funny line I heard at a meeting once. The person said, "Be kind to your sponsees. You never know when one of them is going to end up as your sponsor." Hey, thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, John, for this compelling and thought-provoking presentation this morning. Thank you so much. Another gem for the archive. We appreciate your service. Share ID for this presentation, 22,444. That's 22444. John's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so please stay tuned for that. And we're going to transition now to a question-and-answer segment. You can pose a question to John by pressing star 1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Rivka R.
Cindy B.
Alexis F. CK in California.
Joanne B. Joanne B. Vermont.
Gotcha, Joanne.
CK in California.
CK.
Michelle C.
Thus far, Michelle C. Thus far, I have Rivka R, Alexis S, Joanne B, CK, Michelle C. Who did I miss?
Cindy B.
Okay, that was it. Thank you, Cindy B. All right, well, let's get started with this list, and we'll have an opportunity to create another list as well. Rivka R followed by Cindy B. Go ahead, Rivka.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much, John. That was really great. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about after the 14 years, when you got that gift, was there anything that you did differently, or was it? How does that gift come about? Thanks.
Well, that's just the thing. It's a gift. And one of the reasons it really hit me, and it didn't hit me for a while, that it was a gift, is I thought about exactly what I did. I would, again, I'm a typical compulsive eater. I would, after relapsing, I'd start again on a Monday, because that's when you start. And I would get to about Thursday, and it would fall apart. It would just fall apart. And it happened over and over and over and over. And finally, I would always get to about Thursday. One Thursday night, I was climbing the walls. I really wanted to eat. And I remember I said to myself, okay, John, you can go eat. You can go binge your brains out. But you can't do that until after tomorrow's abstinent breakfast. But if that's what you want to do, you're free to do it. But for now, let's try something else. And I remember trying to call a friend or two. I think another part that helped me a lot is that during that time, God, I don't know how long it was. I must have gone through about four sponsors in about 6 months or more. And they all were wonderful people. And when I relapsed, they'd be like, oh, well, think good thoughts, or here, read this page of the big book, or do this. They were very positive, but it just wasn't helping. I was still, not able to do it. And so finally, I ended up with a sponsor. I remember his name was Ward. And Ward said to me, okay, you're in your first 30 days of abstinence. It's going to suck. And I just had to laugh at it. And the reality is, it didn't suck for 30 days. And most of the times it didn't. And when it didn't, wow, I felt like I was ahead of the game. And when it did, I just said, well, that's what Ward told me. It's like, I think expectations can make or break your early abstinence, and accepting, I tell people all the time that acceptance is an important part, not just acceptance overall, which is really good, but acceptance that we have a disease and that we're going to occasionally, I don't care how pink of a pink cloud you're on, sooner or later you're going to want to eat, and what can you do to keep that from happening? In the recovery business, we talk about the average craving lasts 20 minutes. See what you can do. But for me, I think part of it was a change in my expectations. And then, here, God knows how many years was I in the program then? And I've been telling everybody for years, a day at a time, well, this was the first time I think I actually did it and said, okay, I'm going to go binge tomorrow, but tonight I'm going to hang in and call some people and do some contrary action. And I love the situation we have now, because I would always be climbing the walls at about 10 o'clock at night. Well, now if it's 10 o'clock at night here in LA, it's going to be morning in London. I can catch a meeting. It's that part has really gotten a lot better. Anyway, Rivka, I don't know if that helps.
Thank you, Rivka, for your question. Cindy B., you're up. Cindy B., star 1 to unmute.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry. I didn't realize I was muted. Hi. Cindy B. from Boston. Thank you so much. It was great to hear such your experience and compassion. So I have a question for you. I actually asked a question to the speaker last week who came also from AA and had gotten sober in AA. And my question was, why did it not transfer? What was the difference? And what she said was that she was treating her food addiction as a character defect. And I wanted to hear what you had to say about the grace and, how you were treating your, coming from AA and how you were treating your food addiction. And also, in the grace, did you experience, was your spiritual practice different than when you finally experienced that grace? Thank you.
Thanks, Cindy. Well, I think the thing I always say is that whatever substance or if it's a process addiction, some kind of behavior that's an addiction, whichever one's the last one is going to be the hardest, because very, very often in, we keep we keep changing deck chairs on the Titanic. I see it a lot with people coming from AA. And I get, it's funny out here because people know I'm in AA. If there's a new person who says, oh, they're from AA, they'll, oh, go talk to John. He's been in the program a long time. And I tell people, you know, there's a good chance that, you know, the reason it was maybe a little easier for me to get sober was that I just changed what I was eating and you know, really went crazy for a while. And the thing is, and you probably heard the joke, the credits just don't transfer. And one of the things I tell them, I've had people that I've sponsored who were like circuit speakers in AA, and they just couldn't hold on to being abstinent. And I tell them the credits do not transfer. I said, you have to try as best as you can to remember where you were when you were a newcomer in AA and lose all of the thoughts. There's a part of you that, and I know I got it all. I know all about this already. But you don't know what the way it is here. And I also tell them, and by the way, you have to lose any judgments about OA, because OA and AA do things a little differently, and some of the things they do in OA can make people from AA want to tear their hair out. But that's just the way it is. We have to be willing to go to any lengths, and part of that is accepting OA as it is. And I think for me, the thing that I'm trying to think, I think I had a real desperation when I got sober, but there was a different kind of a desperation by the time I got abstinent, because I had years of trying to get it, you know. You know, I was only 26 when I got sober, so I hadn't had years of trying that. I did a quick downhill slide and was in really bad physical shape when I got sober. But I had spent so much time trying to get abstinent that I think I hit a certain desperation thing. You know, I sometimes talk about the disease having like all these threads that can get to people, like, you know, the food is a reward, you know, because as a kid we got, oh, here, have this if you're feeling bad, or food is soothing, or food is this. And one of the ones that's really hard for people who've been relapsing for a long time is the hopelessness thread, meaning you're committed to program, you're committed to your abstinence, you've gotten abstinent, you're doing okay, but there's a part in the back of your brain that goes, come on, you know how this ends. This is the way, you've been at this abstinent before, but you know what, you always crash and burn. And, you know, the reality is that's the empirical evidence they have, but it doesn't have to be that way. Plenty of people, myself included, went at it over and over until it caught. And so I think part of that was that, and part of that being willing to go to any lengths and trying to get a little bit more of a spiritual practice. You know, for me, getting up every day and doing some readings. I'm a big believer in it. It doesn't matter. I've got a stack of books here of various readers. And sometimes just pull out a different one, because anything you're going to read in the morning is going to all of a sudden put you in a little bit of a 12-step headspace. And very often what you read is something you would never have thought about until you read it. And invariably during the day, it'll come up. So anyway, that's about what I can think of. It's about the credits don't transfer, and it's the last one's going to be the hardest.
Thank you, Cindy B., for your question. Alexis F., your turn.
Thanks, John. I get a lot of common sense from you, and I feel like you're at peace with yourself and others. So I have two questions. One is, how do you detach from ego? What do you do? And would you say I had a problem yesterday with eating a dressing that had sugar as the last ingredient, the 11th or 12th? And would you say that was broken abstinence? And also, I took the fat from my lunch and put it with my breakfast, put it with my dinner to have 2 tablespoons of dressing. Would you say that's broken abstinence? I'm a low bottom compulsive overeater.
Okay, well, let me answer a couple of those. First, when it comes to food, I can only give just the slightest bit, because everybody is different about things. You know, I hear people say, well, I ate something and it had sugar as a 15th ingredient and it caused me to go out. And I go, you know, there's a line in the big book. I think it's page 100, 101, with the, talking about the Eskimo up in the Arctic. But it said something like, if they cannot do that, they still have an alcoholic mind. And in other words, if eating something that's 12th down on the list is going to make you go out, you're going to go out on something else, you know. But you have to figure that out for yourself. I've had sponsees who told me about what they ate, and they said, do you consider that I should reset my abstinence or not? And I go, here's the question. Which of the answers I give you will keep you from doing it again? Because some people may say, you know what, I really just need to reset my abstinence or I'm going to keep messing around. And other people, it would only, you know, discourage them and it wouldn't help them and it might not have been a very big thing. And so that's one of those things. It's really hard to, you know, tell anybody else about. Really yourself, hopefully you have a sponsor and you can be honest about, because that's the most, I think the thing you need more than anything is a sponsor you can feel, you can talk to about. If you're, I always say lying to your sponsor is like playing hide and seek with yourself, you know. In terms of detaching the ego, I could go on for a long time about this, but you know what I'm going to do? It's self-referential time here. The last special edition I did, oh no, I'm sorry. The last special edition I did was on relapse. The one before that was about ego, because it was one of the things that hit me one day. I went, wow, why have things gotten really different in the last couple of years? And I realized, wow, you know, my ego is really gone. I still give you my opinion, but if you don't agree with it, it's fine. And all of the kinds of things like that. And I just noticed that that was always causing me so many problems. And part of that was, you know, ego's on the top level. If you keep scraping down, for me, it was underneath that, was the character defect was fear. And, you know, I think almost everything, you know, if you scrape enough, you're going to get the fear. And then the biggest fear for me was fear of not being enough. And I'm not enough. I'm not as good as you. I'm not a good enough man. I'm not enough good enough husband. I'm not a good enough this or that. And something happened, and all of a sudden I was like, okay, I guess I am good enough. You know, I'm not perfect. You know, and I always used the line. I said, we're all just these little kids running around with these adult suits on, and none of us got the manual. You know, we forget that all the time. None of us came into life with a manual on how to do everything. So we spend our entire lives in trial and error, trial and error, trial and error. And what do? We beat the crap out of ourselves for every error we've ever made, you know? And the more I could go, well, I'm really not happy about that, but okay, that was the person I was today. It didn't get the manual. You know, that whole idea, we will not shut the door, you know, not want to shut the door in the past is an important thing. So if you get a chance, go listen to the special edition I did two before. You'll see it has ego in the title. I don't remember what it was. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Alexis F. Next up, Joanne B. Your question, please.
Hi there.
You went dead.
Go ahead.
I got a hi there.
Go ahead, Joanne. Joanne, star one to unmute.
Hi, sorry about
Neither
that. I'm here. Hi, John. Thank you so much. I have a question about sponsorship. I love your message about abstinence. And so here's my thing. It's like, I feel like I am recovered from a lot of those food behaviors like binging and, you know, turning to food as a solution to my problems. However, I don't have entire abstinence. My abstinence, you know, I may eat a little bit more at a certain meal. Maybe I eat something, you know, extra here and there. Am I still fit to sponsor people? That's my, because I sometimes get the message I've been getting is, you know, unless you have entire abstinence 24/7 for 30 days or more, you can't sponsor. But so what's your feeling on that?
Okay. Yeah, sure. I'd be willing to talk to you about that. You know, what this says about in the big book on sponsorship is nothing, because there's no sponsoring in the big book. this is another one of those things where I think I mentioned it right in the beginning. We come in and we start getting input from everybody else about what abstinence is and what program is and what, you know, all these things, and forget that we can step back and say, well, wait a minute. I never heard the phrase entire abstinence until I came to program. What the heck is that? You know, it's somebody's construct of how you should be versus, is this what you want? Is this, you will have a sense of whether you're sane or not with your program pretty easily. And like you said, it's about not turning to food as a way to, you know, this, you know, squash emotions, you know? And it's the line I always say is, you know, the line I heard one time was, if you're a compulsive eater and you're using food as an option, it's always going to be the only option. And to me today, food cannot be an option for emotions. Do I eat more than I should? Sometimes, sure, I do. You know, I mean, I try not to, but heck, you know what happens. And I'm sure I could find, I don't know how many people who would get up and say, well, you see, that's not entire abstinence. But that's a decision I get to make. And I think it's so important. That's one of the things I was really trying to say in the beginning is you get to make these decisions. Don't follow other people's constructs if they don't work for you. Now, maybe it is a good thing. And again, this whole thread and the needle thing of it could then, if somebody's saying something, it could be your disease saying, well, don't listen to them. They're telling you what you don't want to do. But at the same time, it can also be the other way. And I think it's so important to try to figure that out. And as to whether you should sponsor, I mean, I think if you have stuff to offer and you're not going out and binging, I don't – again, everybody makes this decision for themselves. But the whole idea of anybody telling anybody else, oh, you shouldn't be sponsoring, that's a decision – you're supposed to be making. I think other people's egos get involved in dictating to others what they should do. And I, like I said in the talk, I'll certainly give you my opinion about things, but this is what I did, or this is what I would do, but not what this is what you should do. And I think a lot of people do that a lot too much. You know, figuring out whether your abstinence is right is one of those things that's really tough. You know, I talk about I do this relapse workshop every week, and I talked about one of the changes in my, you know, I mentioned in the beginning, I've changed my views on program a lot, you know, and I come from hardcore AA when it comes to relapse, you know, and I was a relapse slip, the same damn thing. Well, you know, having gotten into the drug and alcohol field, I see that there can be such a thing as a slip and a relapse, a slight difference. You know, somebody goes through treatment, you know, maybe stay two or three cycles or 28 days, and they're committed and they've got a sponsor and they're going to meetings like crazy, and they go out and something happens. They have that strange mental blank spot and they drink one night and they're just devastated and they're just destroyed because that's not what they wanted to do. That could be a slip because they could use that to learn and it could become the thing that changes. It better for them. You know, they talk about how a bone is stronger where it broke and healed than it is anywhere else. Then we have the other kind of person who leaves our rehab, who's there probably because somebody wanted them to be there or whatever, and they just go out and yeehaw, they're just back to doing whatever they're going to do. I said the one that's the saddest is the person who just has a slip, but it turns into a relapse because of their shame, because of what they've been told, and, oh, that's it. And again, it comes down to I'm the only one who benefits or loses by eating or not eating. I get to decide how that should be for me. And I know that sounds a little, you know, loosey-goosey, but at the same time, one of the things I try to say to people is stop and ask yourself, even if you have 15 of your friends saying the exact same thing, well, where did that come from? Where, you know, okay, you know, there's a guru out there, but is that in the big book anywhere? You can choose to listen to a guru or not listen to a guru, but what's going to work for you? That's the bottom of everything. You know, I see people trying to put a square peg in a round hole. This person says you should do it this way, and it's not working, and then people get discouraged and leave instead of saying, well, maybe there's a different way. And that's one of the things I was trying to get across in the talk. So I hope that helps.
Thank you, Joanne B. CK, your turn to pose a question. Hi, can I be heard?
Yes.
Okay, thank
Good
you
question,
so much.
Please.
Mm-hmm. This is CK in California, and thank you so much, John. It was really great to hear you again. I love your share, and it was great to hear
you.
My question. Sorry?
No, I said yes. It's nice to see you, too.
Yes, okay. So my question is about sponsoring. And, you know, I love what you said about the, how there's not enough sponsors, and I'm so grateful that our fellow in Scottsdale helped me understand that I need to sponsor now, and I'm just willing to get over myself, the notion that I'm not qualified to sponsor. And so what I wanted to know is, you know, the thing you said about the steps today, you know, gave me a new perspective. And I was wondering, as a sponsor, how do you explain the importance of starting the steps over after relapse?
Well, that's a good question. I'll just give you, when I was in that other program for a while that had the very strict thing, and they even, you wrote on different questions, I kept seeing people going over and over, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and maybe, you know, on some level, they're, you know, on a totally subconscious level, maybe they're doing that because they want to get the 4 and 5, you know? I think it's an important thing. It's an important thing to write about powerlessness. You know, I do a whole talk about how, for me, I had the illusion of that I would say I was powerless, but I keep going out and binging. So how powerless did I really think I was? And part of the problem is if you've gone in and out enough, you get the feeling, well, wait a minute, I've done this before, I can do it again, which you can. But you need to pull the camera back and realize, God, I've been doing this for years, in and out, in and out. So how powerful am I in reality? You know? Let me just say, by the way, this is the one place I got the most pushback from sponsees was when I told them it was time to start sponsoring. Oh, no, I'm not ready. I'm going to mess people up. Oh, my God. You know, and first of all, you know, get over yourself. You're just there to be of service. You're there to talk about your experience, strength, and hope. And if you have a question that you don't have an answer to, that's okay. I always tell the story. I used to have a sponsor, Carl, and we had a wonderful chain of people. And I had a sponsee say, when I asked him to be a sponsor, well, what if they ask me something I don't know? I said, well, tell them you'll get back to them and call me and ask me. And guess what? I might not know, and I'll call Carl. And if Carl doesn't know, he'll call Jack. And if Jack doesn't know, he'll call Carol. And if Carol doesn't know, he'll call Natalie. And if Natalie doesn't know, she'll call God. And God used to pick up for Natalie. But the point being is I tell people they don't have to have all the answers. They just have to be there to share their experience, strength, and hope. Look at those first 100 people. You know, do you think they were being told to wait around before they helped other people? You can at least help people up to a certain level. And again, I think some of it is deciding, you know, if you've, you know, restarted the steps over and over, is that the best thing to do, or to work on other stuff, you know? You know, at the end of the day, realizing if you keep slipping, there's definitely an incongruity between what, you know, the program says about powerless and what at least your subconscious is saying about powerlessness. I don't know if that helps, but that's the thought.
Thank you, CK. Michelle C., your turn.
Hi, good morning. This is Michelle C. in California. Two questions for you, John. I'm on step 8, 9, and 10, and I am just struggling with a script that my sponsor gave me for step 8. I just find it, to me, it seems a little bare and heartless. And then I kind of took the other extreme where I started writing quite a bit and came up with these like long, you know, draft amends with a lot of what I thought was empathy. And I'm just really having a hard time with that. I was wondering if you have any other resources or suggestions on how to look at other step 8 amends drafts. And then the other question I have for you is, I was also in a more stricter program when I first came into to program for food, and my first sponsor fired me, and that was about 6 months ago. And I'd done step, you know, 4 and 10 on the experience, and that was 6 months ago. Yeah, it's amazing how it still comes up and it still hurts, that shame and what I felt like, what I heard from her. If you've got any other kind of tips to, I don't know, how to let go of a negative experience when you know that this is a program that you want to do, and that experience is just part of my journey.
Thanks. Well, you know, I said in the earlier that, you know, we sponsor at the level we are at, and some people, like I said, aren't as far up as they think they should be. But I also, you know, I tell people, hey, you know, there's no sponsor school out there. There's nowhere where you can go and learn how to be a sponsor. There's no test. Do you have enough recovery to become a sponsor? And so everybody is sort of doing this, you know, based on whatever construct they put in their head about what a sponsor is supposed to be and what a sponsor is supposed to do. And again, to me, the key is to try to take the ego out of it and say, you know, okay, you know, I joke with my sponsees. I always say to them, please be honest about your food. I promise if you go binge, I won't gain a pound. You know, the point I'm making is I have the ego separation that they are them and I am me. And if they do something, it's not hurting me, it's hurting them. So why am I wanting to hurt them more? You know, but again, people sponsor from where they're at and they may not have that same level of growth. About step eight, I have always said step eight is the one step you really want to get some outside guidance on. Now, maybe, I don't know, maybe your sponsor's not the right one to get guidance on, but get from others. Only because I joked about how I'd write up an eight-step list that included, you know, the ant I stepped on in the first grade, or, you know, incredibly lots of stuff that really shouldn't be on there. It's about, you know, making amends, you know, to those you've harmed, and realize that, well, where's the actual harm? You know, you don't go up to somebody and say, you know, I thought you were an idiot my whole life. You know, nothing had to do with it. But the other end of the thing is, well, I want to sweep certain things under the rug because, boy, I really don't want to have to make this amends. And so you need an objective third party on that kind of thing, too, to say, okay, you know, is this something that, you know, because you can always use that except when to do so would injure them or others loophole. And sometimes it's, you know, except when to do so is going to injure my ego loophole. That doesn't count. And so the idea of trying to find, a balance there. And part of it is you can also ask yourself, if I don't make this amends, is it going to really be gone when I'm done? You know, because the whole idea here is, you know, when we do these steps, if we get through the four and five and we work on six and seven and we do eight and nine, you know, and we work through to, you know, the first pass, it's like, that, okay, what happened there was John 1.0. I'm starting John 2.0. And if John 2.0 starts and is still thinking about this one person, maybe I should have made amends to, then chances are I should have, you know, and they should have been on the list. But, like, this is also like a lot of the other things I say, your step eight list has to be your step eight list. Take input, but you get to be the one at the end, not a sponsor who says, no, don't put that on. Don't put that on. You know, I'll say, remember what it says about, you know, this is about people you've actually harmed, not people who you've had grievances against that you've never done any actual harm to, or people that have, you know, ticked you off or whatever. It's just about trying to clean up the side of the street where you actually spilled something on the street, let's just say. So anyway, I don't know if that helps.
Thank you, Michelle C. We have time for two, perhaps three more questions. Anyone else? Star one to unmute.
Amy J.
Diana V. from Connecticut.
Patricia Ann.
Okay, I've got it. Okay. Let's begin with Amy J, followed by Diane V, please.
Okay, thanks. This is Amy. So my question is, I'm dealing with both alcohol and food. So what would you recommend? Would you recommend getting an OA sponsor and trying to put down substances with an OA sponsor, or do I have to get... Or would you recommend getting a sponsor in both programs? That's my question. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Sure. I would definitely recommend a sponsor in both programs, because there's things a sponsor in AA is not going to have a clue about with having to do with food and vice versa. And I'll just tell the story is that I came in, I got sober, I was doing crazy things with the food that caused me to relapse with the alcohol for a short time. And when I came back, by then I'd heard about AA, OA, and I knew I had to go to both. And, you know, when I said my new sponsor, then I need to go to OA too. And, they, you know, in AA, they're like, oh, don't worry about that. Just worry about staying sober right now. Here, have a candy bar. And I just said to him, no, I know myself. I know that these two things are absolutely intertwined, and I need to do both. And he said, okay, fine. You make the meetings I want you to go to. I don't care what the hell you do. So I went to OA at the same time, because they were inextricably linked. And so for some, you know, what could be said for a lot of people is, oh, just work on the alcohol right now. And then when you feel you got, you know, some firm footing under your feet, then get to work on the food. And that might be the way to go. But for me, I sort of had to do both, because I knew they were, one could pull me out of the other at any given time, and vice versa, you know. I knew I needed to do both. If you had to choose between one of the two, I'd say alcohol should be the one to make sure, you know, the most, because that can be the most deadly, deadly not just to you, to other people. But yeah, you got to do them both and try and learn to keep that sort of separation between the two. You know, because you need to be able to deal with both things, and you need the person who knows where you've been. Again, there's AA people out there who don't have a clue. They'll just tell you, well, just stop eating, you know, which, yeah, if we could, right? So anyway, I don't know if that helps.
Thank you, Amy, for your question. And Diane V, your question, please.
Hi there, it's Diana. An A.
Diana.
Thank you. So thank you so much, John. I've listened to a lot of your special editions and such, and I just wanted to thank you. One question I have is, how do you tell when you're picking a sponsor? If you have a sponsor that was like you were back in the day compared to like the type of sponsor you are now? I know I've had quite a few sponsors that you were like that were similar to you, like back in the day. It was hurtful, but I realized that, like you said, that they needed to sponsor the way that they needed to sponsor. It was more about them than it was about me, but it was still really tough to go through that. Do you have any suggestions?
I'll give you a couple things. I've said, now this is, again, this may be heresy to some people out there, but I've said sometimes having no sponsor is better than having a bad sponsor. Not that I would recommend people go without a sponsor for very long if they can't help it. I'll just tell you a quick story. There was a guy who lived here in LA, and he had, God, what's he got? I think he's got 50 years of sobriety, and he's got like 40, I think, in abstinence. And he moved away, and I sort of reconnected him through a third party. And he called me one day about a week ago, and he said, "Hey, my sponsor died, and I need another sponsor." And part of me wants to go, "What? Me sponsor you? Well, you should."
John, we lost you. Hopefully you're trying to get back to the line.
Oh, I love my phone company. I'm just sitting here with my phone. Yes. Oh, I'm so sorry. I was just saying that I had this person, and he was just so admirable and a power of example that this guy's actually got more time than me, but he knew he shouldn't be without a sponsor for very long. And I think, to me, that's that's the power of example there. You know, I'm still a little, you know, intimidated, but I'll try and help any way I can. And you know, you get to a certain point. I have other sponsees that people know and that are really well known, and we're not really. I mean, yeah, we're a sponsee sponsor, but it's really more objective third party, just a friend who can call you on your BS. You know, asked you about picking a sponsor. Well, one of the things is I'm a big believer in sort of interviewing almost. In other words, don't. If you hear, I don't know how you go about it, but just if you hear somebody who you like what they have to say and you have a way to talk to them offline a while, then maybe have a chance to decide and maybe ask them about how they sponsor and things like that. And if it sounds like it's a good fit, then try it. And one thing I always say is don't feel – you know, I used to be such a people pleaser. I felt like if I let a sponsor go, oh, they were going to just totally be whatever. And I've had people do that to me. And I'm like, it's okay. If this isn't a good mix, then you have to find the right mix. And so it's okay to move on. Just make sure you're not moving on because the sponsor's telling you something you don't want to hear. But also some people's, you know, if there was one message I try to get across to people, this talk is try not to be as a hard ass a sponsor as I was, because I don't think it helped anybody. You know, try to find somebody who can have some compassion, but he's willing to call you on your BS, because our disease is intertwined with what we think is perfectly logical thinking. Very well, you know, you may be about to put a glass of whiskey in a thing of milk and thinking it's okay. So I don't know if that helps.
Thank you, Diana. Thanks to all who posed questions this morning. And of course, thank you so much, John, for this illuminating and most valuable presentation. We appreciate it.
Can I just make a quick pitch? If anybody needs a good relapse meeting, there's one at 9 o'clock Pacific and 12 o'clock Eastern, having to do with relapse that we on. It's on Zoom. You can get the information on the OA website. But it's a wonderful community we've got going. He's sort of using the way I've been talking about in the talk today.
Fabulous. Wonderful. Thank you very much. Once again, the share ID for today, 22,444. That's 22444. We're going to close now from page 164. You'll notice it's in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past, and freely of what you find, and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until.